This is Ralph Carhart, the author of The Hall Ball, and you are listening to Baseball and Barbecue.
Listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts, and I know it's one of yours too. The only problem is, after I get done listening to it, I'm hungry. All right, guys, take it away.
Welcome to episode 91. 91? That's right.
Wow.
Of Baseball and BBQ. Wow, you're jumping in. You're raring to go, aren't you?
Well, yeah, of course. Why not?
Tell who you are.
I'm Jeff Cohen, and you?
I'm Len Aberman, and I'm damn excited to be here.
Damn glad to see you.
Yeah. Jeff, 91. When we get to 100, I think we stop saying numbers. We just say baseball and barbecue.
We'll see.
All right.
So, Len, Jeff, this episode is fresh off your appearance. Let's say second appearance on the Greg Rempe Barbecue Central Show.
The Barbecue Central Show, yes.
And
with your host, Greg Rempe.
And this time, we heard you. And you were fantastic.
Thank you very much.
I must say, though.
Well, thank you very much.
I must say that you and Greg gave yours truly a little ribbing, you know, barbecue humor there.
Yeah. Pardon the pun.
Pardon the pun. But I hope now with this new microphone I have in front of me that I sound better and it's up to Mr. Rempe's standards.
You know what? You sound awesome.
Well, does it matter what you say? I guess I have to know what Greg Rempe is going to say about the way I sound.
You know, well, Let's see what he says. We're going to see what he says. But we want to thank Doug Scheiding, right?
Yes, we do, yes.
Because not all. So Doug Scheiding, who will be with us on this episode.
With Grubbs, yes.
With Grubbs, right? So this episode, for everyone, before we get carried away and forget who's on, to let everyone know, we've got part two with Grubbs from Netflix, of course, but he's more than that. The guy is just, he's a personality.
Yes.
And then, of course, we have Stu Thornley.
Now, Stu Thornley is very important to the game of baseball because without Stu Thornley does, you couldn't do a game without him. He is actually an official scorer. He does the Minnesota Twins games, mm-hmm. but you know what? Every team, every game needs an official scorer, and his part is integral.
Yeah, of course, because, I mean, you got to know, you got to be told, was it an error or not?
Right.
No, but what he does as official scorer is affects the statistics.
Absolutely.
If Stu Thornley, if a guy's pitching a no-hitter and he rules a ball a hit, there goes the no-hitter.
That's right.
If he rules it an error, the no-hitter's still intact. So That's pretty big because no hitters are part of history, and it's not just that.
Yeah, but absolutely, and he'll tell us all about it.
Yeah,
and we absolutely. Also have a guest host with that interview.
Another guest? Would you tell us, or you want me to tell you?
Well, I'll tell you. It's one of our good friends, and you can tell us who it is.
Gary Mack.
There you go.
Yes. This is episode 91, and you know what, Jeff? It's been too long. You know, we release every 2 weeks, sometimes with bonus episodes, but I think the fact that it's 2 weeks, we're excited. We've got great content for you guys. We're so glad that you joined us. I mean, a lot happens over 2 weeks. Like you said, I was on with, of course, with Greg Rempe on the Barbecue Central Show. You know what? what people don't know is that he took so much time with me, besides the mentoring on this show, okay, which I've spoken about. He took so much time with me to test the microphone, to test the sound. He did it not just once, because one time it didn't work, but twice. And we appreciate that, because he helps us to promote this show. For those of you who are listening, because you found us, because you listen to his show, we thank you, and we hope that you'll stay with us. We think we've put out some great content, so we're excited about it.
Yes, and yeah, your appearance on Greg's show was absolutely fantastic.
Thank you, and I know that you have an appearance coming up, right, on Mets Musings with none other than Gary Mack.
It's the current episode, yes.
Right, so that's going to be that. When this podcast is released on Saturday, that episode should be out.
Exactly.
And will you be ranting on that about our very beloved Mets?
I don't know if ranting is the right word. I mean, I do get a little bit excited, but it wasn't all full out rant.
Okay. Well,
let me tell the people, if they want to get in touch with us, give us a call at 516-855-8214. Email us at baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Our Facebook page, and our YouTube is both Baseball and BBQ. Twitter, we're at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe to us. Although now I hear subscribe is not the right word. You have to follow. So follow is now the word to so subscribe, follow, do whatever you like.
just do it.
Exactly.
Like Nike says, or right, just do it.
Do it.
All right. So Jeff, without further ado, which I know you love, let's get the party started and start with part two with Grubbs and Doug Scheiding. Enjoy, guys.
Grubbs, I want to ask you about your personal, when you go out and cooking. I see you have a van or a trailer that you have Grubbq. You go out and festivals and stuff like that?
No. Let me tell you that. What I do where I live, I sell sausage by the pound. If you're having a party and you call me or message me and say, hey, Grubbs, look, man, we got like eight people coming up to Georgia. People rent cabins up here. We need, you know, a couple of chickens, a pan of macaroni and cheese. I'm the man for the job. And I'm going to be cheaper than any damn barbecue joint in town because I ain't got all that overhead. So that's what I do, man. I do private thing. My main gig up here is I cook ribs to raise money to fight cancer. That's how the Grubbq got started. That's why I do what I do right here. And I'll do anything. If you want to pay a lady, pay me to do a party for briskets. I said, look, whatever the brisket costs times three, pay me $300. You got briskets. Okay, she says. So, you know, I do what I do, man. It's like, it's just, I sell sausages. I sell butts. I sell whole chickens. And I can only do 12 chickens at a time because that's all the refrigerator in the basement will hold. You know, it's not like I got a damn restaurant. So when I sell chickens, I got 12 chickens I got to brine because I always brine my chickens. So it takes 24 to 36 hours to brine a chicken. And I only got so much room in the refrigerator in the basement to hold these chickens. So you get, when I said, look, Grubbs are selling chicken. I sell 12 chickens in 5 minutes, man. It ain't nothing. You know, if I could probably sell 24, but I don't have room to brine the 24 because I don't have a restaurant. You know, and I have a big food tub that I can put these chickens in. I got 8 gallon buckets that are food safe that I can brine chickens in, but I can only do 12 at a time. So when I do chickens, there's 12 chickens. When I do butts, I do maybe 12 butts at a time, and I sell the whole butts, you know. So, and even ribs, that's the whole thing. It's all about space for me because I'm just at my house. I got two freezers and an extra refrigerator in the basement, but I can only do so much, you know. But that's what I do locally, you know.
I'm checking out your Facebook page, your Grubbq Facebook page, and you recently posted something for HBT smokers. Looked like a lot of great equipment there. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, that looked great.
My HBT smoker, man, the firehouse, I love that thing. This is my second HBT smoker. If you look at the pictures, the way I bought this smoker, the box style reverse flow smoker, for this exact purpose of hanging sausages and smoking them. I'm telling you, it's a beautiful sight. It'll cook a whole hog up to about 100 pounds. Okay, so in the middle shelf, I can fill it up with 45 butts. Because I cook for the fire department and everything else up here too. So, you know, it's all it's utilitarian, but HBT, man, those guys over in Alabama is where they're at. They build reverse flow smokers. I know people up here in Georgia, because we live there, all Lang and Bubba and this, that, and the other, but HBT has been killer to me. Awesome. The guys hooked me up to my first one. I sold it after I got my second one. Gave me a deal on this one. And it's a hell of a smoker, man. It's a reverse flow, big box smoker. I opened both doors, got them three shelves stacked up. But I pulled them out, and I had rods made to hang them sausages on. And, dude, because my goal, I'm trying to be the sausage sensei up here. If I open a shop, it's not going to be a barbecue shop, restaurant. It's going to be a smokehouse. It's going to be a sausage shop. Maybe I'll do hams occasionally, so some jerky. But it's going to be a smoke shop and takeaway only. Because that's what I love to do, man. It's fun to me. And I'm not going to work myself to death doing it. I have too much fun doing it. I want to have fun doing it.
Absolutely. I don't blame you whatsoever.
Grubbs, HBT is the bomb, man.
Grubbs, did they, I'm still hooked on the show. We go back and forth on this show. We go all over the place. So
it's okay.
Did you guys film every day or did they give you a break? No.
Yeah. Well, every other day almost. Okay. So I made it through five episodes on the show. I was there 12 days. Okay. And there was one time where you had a day and a half off even because you hit a wall. I mean, there's a lot of pressure, you know, one day, then you film all day. I'm telling you, for anywhere from the lowest one might have been 12 hours, you know, so 12 to 17 hours. The next day, you just have interviews and meetings. And then the next day, you go back and start shooting again. But one day, they gave us like a day and a half off because it was like, they were just trying, I think it was right before the sandwich tournament thing. So they gave you an extra day off, but it's just like decompressed, man. I mean, go hang out in the pool, whatever, you know what I'm saying, at the hotel. Because we were in one hotel. The whole crew was in another hotel right next door to us. So, and you weren't allowed to have a car or nothing. And they had a gate watcher, whatever. I know they're called crew wranglers, whatever, but I call them the gate watchers or the mind keepers or whatever. They're sitting down in the lobby. So if you come down the hotel, you can't exit the hotel without them seeing you. Because you wasn't allowed to just roll up and go where you want to go. You know what I'm saying? You had to get permission.
Did you have someone kind of tagging along with you, like a handler as well? You know,
yeah,
so that
yeah,
kind of
called,
everywhere
yeah,
with you?
They're called crew wranglers is what they're called. And so like they
crew
would,
wranglers.
Yeah, they would feed us, you know, like, okay, a few times we all went out together and sat at IHOP or whatever the hell was around the hotel or wherever we wanted to go. But it was like at a blink of an eye, they said, okay, we're taking orders for dinner, what you want. You can order anything, any damn place you want, and they'd go get it for you. You know what I'm saying? And you bring it there. A lot of us ate in the conference room. A few people ate in their hotel rooms, but down in the lobby. So we hung out in the lobby a lot. And afterwards, sometimes we'd be sitting around, we'd be sharing drinks in the lobby, you know, as a group, instead of, you know, in everybody's room. Because everybody had
their
own
room. With the crew wranglers there, too.
Yeah, and the crew, there's always a crew wrangler, always. I call them the gatekeepers, always, always.
They went to the restroom with you. Did they go to the restroom with you?
No, not when you was at the hotel. And when you was on set, we had one in the back corner that people could go to. But when you were sitting in that little tent while they was, like, judging or asking questions or beforehand, you said, hey, I got to go to the bathroom, they would have to walk you to the fancy porta-johns they had on set, you know.
Were you mic'd up in the bathroom too, and at all times?
No, once you got there, that's the whole thing in the morning. That's hey, you was mic'd. Once you got there and had breakfast, that was part of you getting there 2 hours before it started. Is you had to get breakfast, everything had to start, and they'd mic you up. So yeah, no, you were mic'd everywhere. That's
yeah.
Remember and that when people talking about watching TV and stuff, how they know that? Well, hell, you're wearing a damn microphone the whole time you was on the show.
Yeah.
You know?
Tina said she said her
I'm
prayer
to cover
in the bathroom.
I go pee sometimes.
Yeah. You couldn't say anything until
or said like who just left this thing.
you couldn't say anything until the short show aired, correct? I mean, you couldn't say. I mean, except your wife maybe, but you couldn't say anything.
Right.
Right.
I mean, we were not. That was all part of the contract. You did what you did. I mean, there's not a person on that show can sit there and tell me their partner or spouse didn't know what was going on. Right. You know, it's not like they said, well, you can't tell anybody but your wife, but you just had to keep it quiet. But, you know, I've been married 33 years now. So it's like, you know, she knew I was there, you know.
Yeah.
When I watch those shows, I always think that the contestants are just praying that they're not the first one who gets eliminated. You just get that feeling. Nobody, I mean, obviously you want to win it, but only one can win. But no, but everybody's like, please don't let me be the first. Am I wrong?
Well, you saw Shotgun went out first on that one. And you had no idea, man. I mean, yeah, I honestly didn't think I'd make it through as many episodes as I made it through. I ain't gonna lie to you. I'm straight up, man. But I was amazed every time that I got through, you know, because if you watch the show and everybody can form their own opinion of how people felt about who or where I ranked as far as the judges went, and that's all fine to form your opinion. It's a television show. They made, you know why they made that show? To entertain people like you. And to get y'all's opinion to ask us to do it. It don't matter what people think about me. I could care less, okay, because it's the viewers that the show was directed to. You know, it's not the James Grubb show. It's the damn barbecue, the American Barbecue Showdown. So let's thrill the people. And I was down with that, man, 100%. It didn't matter to me. And I took that the whole time on that show that it wouldn't matter to me. I got a little choked up at the end when I left, but it was so emotional because it was such a roller coaster. And the same token, you're like, man, it's over. You know, finally you got a little breath of fresh air because it's high intensity, man. It's a real deal. And I'd have never thought, I mean, I knew Netflix was big, but I ain't never been a big Netflix fan, that it would go to where it went, in my opinion. I never personally, you know, so I'm still to this day kind of humbled by it. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I love living in my little hole up here in the damn woods where people don't see me. You can't roll up on my house. I can see you 100 yards away. If I don't like you, I'll get the dog on you. You know, so. But I like that, you know. Yeah. But I had so much fun doing the show.
Grubbs, Duck Chiding is a champion barbecue competition. Do you do any competitions?
I do. I don't do. The only competitions I've ever done are local competitions to raise money to fight cancer,
which is a wonderful thing. Let me say. I mean, I know
that's it, man.
Yeah.
But I've won them a lot. I've won them a lot. But you know, like I say, this is no KCBS. This is not like my rib got a bite through at a half moon mark and all this other nonsense. It's just, it's usually the sheriff or the county commissioner or maybe some local stock brokers or somebody. That's your judges. You know. And it's all about raising money to fight cancer. And it's, you get bragging rights and you get a little trophy for the year. And that's what it's all about, man. I mean, let's look, take five rib teams. Okay. Put it together. Five little barbecue teams selling ribs at the Relay for Life in Union County, Georgia. We raised $10,000, you know, so that's what it's all about, man.
That's fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, I've never done a KCBS competition. My kids have done a Kid Q at one sanction at Brasstown Valley Resort up here in Georgia, and they've won it with a perfect 180 score on chicken. But I've never, ever done one, you know.
Grubbs, when you're in the bottom two, and I don't want to ruin the show for people who haven't seen it, but I don't know what the statute of limitations is on a Netflix show. I mean, how many months have to go by before you
I don't know. They're still watching it. Right? People are still just now watching it, you know.
But I think people pretty much know now at this point that you didn't win the show. So when you're in the bottom two and on the show that you lost, so two things. One, what's that feeling when you're in that bottom two? Describe what you're thinking and just what you're feeling as you think you might be eliminated. And then what about the one where you and both you and I, was it Sylvie? I think it was you and Sylvie, right?
Yeah, we both got rode through it.
Right, and then they decided, obviously they liked you guys because they didn't want you to leave yet. And so they said, you know, we can't have these guys out. So we want you to be in the show.
Right, plus you got to realize, the next episode after that was the sandwich tournament. And you needed so many people to fill out the bracket of the sandwich tournament. Right. Okay, so let's go with that. I'm not saying that's what it was.
But what's the feeling?
Is it almost
like relief, or is it, what are you thinking as you're standing there? And how long do they make you, you know, wait in the wind and just, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, this is the way it went. After, when they said time's up, we threw our hands in the air, and that was it. They came and got your food right then from your station. Okay. Culinary came and got one, which is the pictures you saw, because the culinary, they would come and take one plate you made that was separate and they'd go do what they did to it, and they take all these nice pictures. I mean, that's what they do. Okay. And then the judges would taste your food and we would have to go back to the little crew tent, sit back way over there. That's when you had to get permission to go to basket like that. You couldn't just hang out there, and you would wait sometimes an hour, hour and a half. You know, and then you come back and they're sitting there, and then you do the whole filming thing where they're actually like tasting the food and shit. But you got to realize that's just way cold by then and stuff. So that ain't even a true, you know, of what you serve, because you just cooked all this food. And then an hour later, they're tasting it and giving you their critique, but it's cold. But they are doing their job. They're tasting it, and that's what they're videotaping it. So you thinking they're tasting it right when we turn it in. And that's all fine. But I'm going to tell you, being in the bottom two, and I said this initially, didn't matter to me, okay? Because I didn't go in. I mean, I wanted to win. I thought, well, this is an alternate, and I come in there, if I could at least make the show, I might actually could win this thing. But when I saw, honestly, when I saw some of the cooks that were there, I knew in my damn mind I wasn't going to win it, but that didn't mean I wasn't going to try. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I went in there gung-ho every damn episode, did the best I could do, maybe, and I mean, in hindsight, I'd have changed a few things, but as it was, like, hey, I came home every day from the hotel, called my wife, said, damn, I'm still here. You just made another so much money per episode. You know, you make it, just do it. You know, because I thought I was going to go home with $700 after 4 days and it'd be over. And all of a sudden, the thousands start ringing up, and I'm a part time grocery stocker in a damn doing health and beauty aids at a grocery store. So here I'm doing what I do with barbecue and making some damn money. I was happy as hell, man. So it didn't matter to me. Okay. I mean, you say what you want to say. First place, when you lose, was the first place is the first place loser. Okay. Second place is the first place loser. It didn't matter to me, man. I was going to go have fun. I knew that going in because I didn't think I was going to make it on the show. Sure. When I got the chance, I wanted to win and best these guys. In my mind, I was like, damn, this is going to be tough, though. I ain't going to lie. It was going to be hard because I knew who these people were. And I didn't find myself on that same level. You know, so I was so much appreciative of just being there. I did the best I could do, and I had fun doing it. And that's, to me, the hell, I'm a winner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whether I got first place, second place, there was 10 of us that started. And I was like fourth or fifth, whatever it was. Hell, that's damn good compared to where we started, you know. So I'm optimistic. That didn't bother me at all, man. I mean, you want to win, but I ain't mad about losing either, you know, because I had so much fun. And the opportunities that have afforded itself from being on the show is amazing. Being in the bottom two was tough, though, you know, especially on that sandwich. I ain't going to lie to you, because I just kept thinking, I got to get beaten up on my damn sandwich. What am I going to do? What am I going to do, you know? But
sauce.
I gave it my best, man, and I had fun, too. Yeah, you know, yeah. You know, I know. Hey, I'm going to tell you, though, I make a killer freaking barbecue sauce. And that was another thing. If you don't even realize, when I had that little crumbly sausage on that last episode, man, I freaked out, and I went back and I whipped up a quick Italian barbecue sauce to go with the sausage, trying to cover up, you know, the dryness of the sausage. And I was thinking, and I got, man, everybody loved it. I didn't show it all on the show, and I said, damn, you know what? Because I'm not a sauce guy. I'm hashtag no sauce, personally. I think if you cook the meat right, you do a recipe right, you don't need no damn sauce on, no way.
Amen.
But, you know, I was there, and I made this sauce, and I said, well, damn, you know. But when people tell you, and they rant and rave about it, it kind of gives you a humbling feeling, you know, but I'm not a sauce guy. I make good sauce, but I don't put it on. I don't think my meat needs it if I cook it right, you know?
I know after your health crisis, situation that you started cooking new, you know, different things. What do you cook at home? What do you eat now instead of the meat like you used to?
Well, no, I still eat meat. I just try to eat a leaner cut of meat.
Oh, and low salt.
Less fat. Yeah, yeah. I mean, instead of having a ribeye, let's go with a tri-tip or a sirloin.
Yeah,
you know, and okay. Instead of having a pork chop, have a loin chop, you know, and then you don't have to cover it with damn salt and stuff. I mean, in my opinion, spicy and flavorful spices can do the same thing salt can do on your tongue. You know, when you bite something with tongue with salt on it, it's going to open your taste buds. And it helps you enjoy the other flavors more. That's what salt does, is it it allows you to take in the other flavors. But there's also peppers and things do that too, where you can put these on your food and substitute the salt and still have good flavor and enjoy the food.
Are you making your own rubs then? You make your own rubs then with that? Yeah, with, you know, because most commercial
I do, and
salt.
I hope to sell them one day. I mean, yeah, I do. And plus, I mean, I've gone through things like I love salad. I absolutely love salad. I might put an egg in my salad. I might put a little stuffed sausage in my salad. What's that about a salad? And the sausage is good for you. Salad's great. It's the damn dressing you put on that's going to kill you. You know what I'm saying? So I've got like 15 or 16 recipes now of salad dressings that got no salt in them whatsoever. But they taste good, you know, because you'll never get away from it, dude. There's no way you're going to get away from salt and sodium and sugar unless you want to eat like a cow, eat go grass in the damn field. And that's all there is to it. So it has to be in moderation. But I'm going to tell you this too, man. If you're cooking burgers, okay, hamburgers, let's give you hamburgers, ground meat in a bowl. Why you got to put kosher salt or salt in there? Put soy sauce instead. You know why? It's got less sodium than salt does, and it's got more flavor. So you can substitute a quarter teaspoon of or half a teaspoon of soy sauce to a half a teaspoon of kosher salt, reduce the sodium by half, and still and add flavor to the meat. You know, there's different ways to do it, but everything's got to be in moderation. I don't care. I ain't giving. I got hot dogs I'm going to cook tonight. Natural skin, no nitrate, but I got them wrapped in bacon. Okay, so my cardiologist might not be happy, but it's really, really good. But it's everything in moderation. You know what I'm saying? Everything in moderation. And there's no reason to turn it all off, but you can control it. And there's ways to get the flavor out of foods. I think spicy foods can substitute salty food any day. You know, when I brine chicken, you know something about brining chickens, right? Salt, sugar, water, aromatics. But I use instead of using a cup of salt and a cup of sugar, half a cup of Cajun seasoning. Because that has paprika, onion, garlic, and all that. And then use a cup of sugar. And I'd rather be sweet and salty anyway. But you're still getting the salt because you have to have the salt do what it does to the meat. Or it ain't going to work. You have to absorb. Have salt.
Right.
You know. I mean, it's moderation, man. It really is. And I'm still down 35 pounds since my heart attack almost 3 years ago. And I weigh 230 pounds. I'm right 190 now. So I guess I'm about 40 pounds down. But it's all about, like the doctor told me for 20 years, grubs, because you cook it don't mean you got to eat it, you know. But it's moderation, man. It's moderation, you know. There's no reason not to, really, especially as we get older. You know, I'm pushing 60 years old now. I like to live for another 30 and barbecue the whole time, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Grubbs, did you ever think of, as I'm watching the show, I guess Melissa kind of commented, did you ever think of doing a flat sausage? Because that kind of seemed to come up. But she was talking about the sandwich, and she was like, well, you know, flat sausages will work. Did you ever think about that?
Well, see, I'm going to tell you that straight up. I can make just plain, what are you talking about? Sausage with no, not stuffed in the casing.
Exactly.
Like a patty.
Exactly.
Yeah. But see, that wasn't the rule when they told us about it, but it was actually asked by some of the contestants during the filming because they didn't want to stuff their sausages. So it's okay. You know, you do what you want to do. Sausage is sausage. But to me, the only sausage you don't put in a cake, it's a breakfast sausage. And you're having that with eggs and pancakes. Everything else, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, goes in a casing. That's just, you know, I grew up eating boudin down on the side of the road for a dollar a stick, you know, in Louisiana. So
it's
got to be in a casing. That's sausage, you know.
Grubbs, if someone wants to follow you on Instagram or Facebook, what's your handle or address?
Yeah, that's what they call me online, at James Barbecue Grubs. That would be at James BBQ Grubs. And I'm on Instagram and Facebook that way. And I got a YouTube channel, and I hope to promote that, start making more videos pretty soon. Any videos that are on there now were short ones that I did to actually get on the show. You had to do so many videos when you were doing to get on the show. And I've shared those. Those were the initial ones on YouTube, you know. But there's great short videos, and it's just like, you know, brine and chicken. Yeah.
We have a YouTube channel also. That's great.
Yeah, but it's James Grubbs, and you'll recognize me. I mean, if people look at the pictures and see the profile, because Ain't too many other people like me in the world.
Actually, I have a friend, and you can be his twin. I swear. I go, I showed my wife the show the other day, and I go, "Who does that look like?" And she goes, "Brendan." I go, "Yeah, that's right."
Not Brian Norwood, here in New York. Though, right?
I'm sorry?
Oh, okay. No, because there's some guy people asked me before, are you kin to Brian? Are you Brian's brother? What the hell? I don't know who the Brian is. I mean, I don't know right there, but no, I'm Grubbs, man. That's just me, you know. Yeah, I do, man. Me. I love living the life, man. I love queuing. And I'm going to tell y'all, if you follow me, stay tuned because there's stuff fixing to happen, okay? And it's all because of Netflix, and I'm appreciative as hell of it. And I'm just going to I'm gonna ride the wave, man. Hopefully I don't have to, you know, stuff condoms and body lotion at the damn grocery store 2 days a week anymore. But because that's what I do in the health and beauty age, man. That's what I do 2 days a week. And I got tattoos to buy and barbecue to do. So, I got to make a living somehow, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, Grubbs, I would definitely watch a show with you. You are personable, charming, just really just fantastic to have on. We have been just big fans of yours on the show, but more than that, just very happy that you came on with us because you are humble.
I appreciate y'all having me, man. Yeah, I really do.
Doug, any final words?
Pardon me?
Oh, I love the Grill Billy and the Grubbecue. Those are great names that you have.
Well, man, I got Grubbecue trademark, you know, and I'm just a North Georgia Grill Billy, man. I do what I do, and I live up here in the woods. I like living in the woods away from large crowds that's going on, and I'm happy with it. You know, but I would not be where I was today if it wasn't for living up here and starting to cook ribs, like I told y'all with a Relay for Life, American Cancer Society. I would have never got Grubbecue to where it is if it wouldn't have been for that, because I cooked enough ribs around and sold enough ribs and raised enough money. People start saying, well, hey, can you cook this for us? Can you do this for us? You know, and that's what started this all out. And it's a blessing, man. It's a blessing because it's so much fun. And you, hey, Doug, you're a barbecue dude, man. You got to know straight up, man, it's like the smoke of the damn gods coming out. When there's hickory in there and the sausages and I'm just standing there and it's like ringing on me, I'm like,
yeah,
man, that's my happy place, man. That's meat therapy. I don't need a – I might be crazy, but I don't need a psychiatrist because I got a grill. You know,
yeah. When your jacket the next day smells like the hickory or
that's
oak
right,
or whatever,
my mustache.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's when you know your job. You did a good job.
Well, I love it. You know, I really appreciate you guys having me on, man. I'm glad.
We appreciate you coming on, Grubbs. It was really fun.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you.
Yeah, y'all too, man. If you ever get down to North Georgia mountains, man, message me ahead of time. We can arrange a chicken or a butt or something. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, we would love that.
You got that.
All right, my friends. Y'all right. Take care and be safe.
Take care.
You bet. Right, thanks, Grubbs.
Cheers.
And we'd like to thank James Grubbs. I mean, I thought that was he's a real character, a real great guy, and he's very generous of his time to talk to us.
Yeah, he loves talking barbecue. He does so much with it. You heard him talking about how does the
he funds the cancer.
Right, exactly. So just down to earth, really nice guy. And to have Doug with us, you know, to have really two pit masters on talking to each other, we really should have just stepped back and let the two of them just kind of pit master to pit master. It's really, but it was a lot of fun. And Jeff, you know that on this show, we promote certain products that we really believe in, that we've had relationships with. And one of them is Baseball BBQ. BaseballBBQ.com. We always say, go there. Great barbecue grilling tools, baseball bat tools. You have to see it. And we had the opportunity to have a quick talk with none other than Brett Mandel of Baseball BBQ. Baseball and barbecue, we are thrilled to welcome back none other than Brett Mandel, who is one half of the team of Baseball BBQ. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? We are Baseball and BBQ. He's Baseball BBQ. If you haven't checked out their website, you've got to do it. It's baseballbbq.com. We're thrilled to have Brett back. You guys are a big supporter of our show. We greatly appreciate it. So, Brett, welcome back to Baseball and Barbecue.
So great to be here. Great minds thinking alike about baseball and barbecue, and it's baseball season, barbecue season. Great time to chat.
Absolutely. Brett, what's new with the site? I see a lot of exciting stuff happening. Why don't you tell us about it?
So I think the last time we talked, we had just rolled out our fork and spatula, and that was basically what we had. You could get our little turn two combo, get the fork, get the spatula. We had some accessories, some cutting boards. We have a home plate shaped cutting board, which a lot of people seem to like. But we've now incorporated a pigtail flipper, a bottle opener, a grill brush, and tongs. And now we have silver slugger sets and all-star sets where you can fill up your entire barbecue stand and be set for the whole season.
Brett, you've got a deal with Major League Baseball, right? So you're going to tell us about that. All right, we'll go in order. Start with that.
Sure. So we just signed a deal with the Major League Baseball Players Association. So we have the rights to put your favorite player's name and signature and number on your tools. So if you like wearing Aaron Judge or Mike Trout on your back, now you can have custom grill tools with their names, their numbers, their signatures. They look terrific and they play really well.
And then you have, of course, I saw this was very cool. You will take someone's bat. So if I have a bat and I love my bat, but it's cracked or I want to have it repurposed as a barbecue tool, you can do that. Go ahead. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So if you have a bat, your bat, your child's bat that you want to memorialize, you can ship it to us. We'll cut off the handle, put the tool on there, whichever tool you want, engrave it however you want, and you can have it for grilling season. You can have it over the mantel place. I'm like you. I cracked a bat at the end of last year. And as I'm running down to first base, I'm mentally mourning this bat that I loved. And, you know, maybe I should have made it into a tool. It ended up just in a trash can. It would be pretty cool if it were sitting in my grill.
That's a great idea to repurpose it as the barbecue tools. It's a fantastic idea.
It's what it should have been to begin with. Let's face it. Now, Brett, also, I love these tongs that you have. So that was what was missing. You had the spatula, had the fork, but no tongs. And now you've got the tongs. Tell us about that.
And all of your fans should know that you guys are a big part of the tong story. Because as you probably know, it's fairly easy to make a fork, right? You're just sticking the fork into the bat handle. Now, we have the patent on that and everything, so that's great. But That's fairly straightforward. To incorporate the baseball bats into the tongs, we tried a couple of different combinations. We had some things that looked sleek, but maybe not so functional. Some were functional, but didn't look right. We brought them to you guys and said, all right, you guys are aficionados. Help us, give us a focus group of two here. And the tool selection that you liked is the one that we made.
All right.
Jeff, I don't even know where to go with that. Well, Do we call our lawyers? I mean,
we'll probably get on the back with that.
That's fantastic. No, we're very happy.
You guys had a 50-50 shot. I mean, you could have been wrong.
Let me ask you this. Let's get back to the baseball players that you have an agreement with. Yeah. Can you do this like for older players, or is it just like the current players? I mean, if I wanted like say for Keith Hernandez, would I be able to do that, it covers all time players? That right?
But only current players. License.
Gotcha.
But we're working on some other stuff that hopefully you can have us on in a future show to do Hall of Famers, greats. But as of right now, if you wanted to put, I'm a Phillies fan, you want to put Bryce Harper on there, terrific. You want to put Mickey Moniak on there? I don't know who you are, but go ahead, put Mickey Moniak on there.
You can't put Mike Schmidt, though. Not yet, huh?
Not yet. Gotcha. Working on that.
Now, if you put Bryce Harper on, the tool's guaranteed to last for 13 years, right? Because that's how long he signed the contract for.
I hope so. Bryce is having a good year for us right now. I'm happy, although we might be better off having a couple of grill forks in center field because our center fielders are giving us no production.
Yeah. Well, we might say the same thing about the New York Mets third baseman. But exactly. That's, you know. So, Brett, another thing that you guys have with is beautiful, is a cutting board shaped like home plate. I love that.
Yeah, these things, we can't keep them in stock. People love them. They're beautiful. They're made in the USA, handmade. We'll engrave them with anything you want. And as I said, people seem to love them. You know, I don't know how many cutting boards I have in my life. Probably the last thing I want is another cutting board, but this one might be the last cutting board that you want.
You guys, from the start, I remember when you first started out, and now you've got, and you have the t-shirts still, and you've got hats, all the, oh, and you have the pig tool.
Pigtail flipper,
yeah. Pigtail, yeah. That's another one. And you got the bottle opener. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. And not only, if you want to have your logo engraved onto the bats, right? You put those on.
That's right.
People's names. You got Father's Day coming up.
Anybody who wants, go to baseballbbq.com. You can see all the tools. If you want to engrave them with something special, we can do that. If you want to take your cracked bat and have us make it into a tool, you can do that. Cutting boards, hats, shirts. We've been having a lot of fun with it. And the nice thing is it's resonated. Obviously, baseball fans like it. Barbecue people like it. They're functional. They feel terrific in your hand. Step up to the plate with confidence.
Absolutely. And I know you also, people can subscribe to your newsletter. You send it out like once a week. So you're not bombarding with people, but to get the latest news on what you guys are doing, I encourage everybody to sign up.
Yeah, we've been having some fun. We've been recording some video podcasts inspired by you guys, and eventually you're going to roll them out. And so I've been talking to a lot of real professional barbecue people and picked up some tremendous recipes. We're going to have a good season this year.
We know anyone that gets your tools. I mean, like we were saying, Howard Johnson, former New York Met, has your tools, loves them. Yeah. So baseballbbq.com. I know I sound like a shill, but we only talk about the tools, and we only talk about the products that we really believe in. We've never had anybody on that we don't believe in their product. You guys are the best. We thank you. Brett, we wish you continued success, and we look forward to having you back on talking about more about baseball and your tools.
Can't wait. Thank you guys so much for your support.
And we'd like to thank Brett for joining us. Check out his website, baseballbbq.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Get that, I think, once a week. Check out his tools. It's great products. And they're doing a lot of exciting stuff there.
And Jeff, by the way, you do sound great. You sound absolutely marvelous. I just realized nobody's even gonna know what that impersonation is. But
thank you very much. They should know that one.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the funny thing is, this interview with Stu Thornley that's coming up, we did this prior to me having a decent microphone, you having a decent microphone. The only two people that sound really good in this podcast, in this episode with Stu, is Gary Mack and Stu Thornley. Thankfully, Stu Thornley does most of the talking.
Right. And without further delay, here's Stu Thornley and Gary Mack.
Baseball and BBQ is pleased to have with us Stu Thornley. Stu is involved in many areas of baseball, including official scorer and author. Some of his books include Minnesota Twins Baseball, Hardball History on the Prairie, The St. Paul Saints, Baseball in the Capital City, Land of the Giants, New York Polo Grounds, and among many others. He's an official scorer for the Minnesota Twins and an online gamecaster. Stu also does official scoring for the Minnesota Timberwolves basketball games and is an active member of the Society of American Baseball Research. Welcome to Baseball BBQ, Stu Thornley.
Thanks, Jeff. Hi, guys.
Hey, Stu. Welcome, Stu.
Stu, let's get started. You're the official scorer for the Minnesota Twins. How does one get a job like that?
Just sometimes it's being in the right place at the right time, although people will contact us and ask about it. And I say just do official scoring wherever you have the chance. If your local college team needs a score, whatever teams are in town, we've got the Northwoods League around here. One of our scorers was the official scorer for a Northwoods League team in Rochester. He's a Mayo Clinic doctor, a gynecologist, by the way. Not that we ever make any wisecracks about that, because we're all very serious. And he wanted to shadow us. Greg Wong is the other official scorer, and me. And I think he was hoping in the course of doing that, that there might be an opportunity for him. And there was. So just taking advantage of opportunities, but doing scoring and getting some experience, knowing the rules. I tell people to officiate on the field, umpire or work any sport where you're going to have to get experience in being decisive and also being told you're wrong all the time, because that's a part of the job and holding up to that sort of thing.
Since we started off right, official scorer, I wanted to ask you about that, obviously. You ever regret a scoring decision that you made?
It happens, and I can think back, and I remember them. You know, I think I remember all of the calls I made that were not just real clear-cut calls, and I can think back on, and sometimes it might be the next day saying, gee, if I had that one back, I'd do it over again. But some of them are going back to when I started, say 2007, where I might look at a player or remember it and say, wow, I called that thing an error. I wouldn't call that an error now. And part of that's, I think, It's a bunch of stuff. One is just you hope you're getting better over time, that you're developing more of a refined eye for seeing different things in a play. But a big part of it is that since 2012, scorers have been getting together in New York every year. And among other things, we can look at a lot of plays. So, you know, there's all these plays. We call them the 50-50s. They could go either way. And as we look at plays, we can zero in and standardize how we're calling it. So that's, I guess, one of the things is before we started doing this, and I can think of some calls that I made that I'd say, gee, now that I see it differently or that we've talked about it as a group, I wouldn't call it that same way now.
If you get a close call, what's the defining point? I mean, we all know what, you know, an error on a ground ball, a guy kicks it or whatever, but you're more involved in it. What's the defining point? What's the fine point that you look for in a replay?
Well, the first thing is to make a decision in my head of what my first reaction is. So it's a hard grounder to the shortstop that he doesn't come up with. And am I thinking, boy, that play seemed kind of tough? Or that my first reaction is that's an error. And especially if I'm thinking error, I probably will then look at the replay. I've got a monitor next to me, and I keep it on about a 7-second delay. So it's real nice that I see the play, I make a decision in my head, and then I can just turn my head and look at the monitor. And I don't even have to wait for all of the other replays that the TV is going to show, see if there's anything that would cause me to change that decision. But how hard it is, and a lot of our scores don't really like the exit velocity that's out there right now. And I agree with them that we can see how hard a ball is hit. We do the eye test on it. But sometimes it's kind of nice to have a number to go with that. Or if nothing else, I might look after the inning. Or now this stuff is coming up on the scoreboard immediately too. And I don't necessarily try to let that influence me, but sometimes if I'm thinking, yeah, that thing was looked like a tough play, pretty hard hit, short hop, and then I look up and I see it was hit at 108 miles an hour, it makes it a lot easier to say, okay, I'm sticking with my thought of a hit. And if nothing else, I sometimes will jot down what the speed of a grounder is in case I get challenged on it afterwards, and I can say, you know, it wasn't hit that hard, or it was. And so we talk, too, about how many steps does an infielder have to take going one way or the other. You know, on the throws, where an infielder's having to hustle on it and making a throw on the run. What's the arm slot? Is he coming up from fielding it low and having to come up from a very low arm slot? So those are the kinds of things that we talk about that I think gives us all a more refined eye and seeing different things in the plays.
I found it fascinating that how analytics now not only influences the game, but also, you know, you say that official scoring, not that it influences you, but you can tell if it's a hard hit or not. It might change your scoring.
Well, sometimes it's just nice to have. I you don't have to use it, but to see a number to go with what you just saw. You said that thing's hit really hard. one time, I didn't have to make a decision on this play, but Miguel Sano was playing third base, and there was a really hard hit. It wasn't a short hop. You know, if those things are short hop that you got to try to play, that's different. But, you know, it took a few bounces, but you could see the thing was, the ground ball to him was really smoked. And it was just one of those hot potatoes, or what you'd say, too hot to handle. And he fumbled it. Well, he picked it up in time and threw it first, got the runner out. And I'm thinking, good, because, I mean, the ball was right at him. It wasn't even off to one side or the other. You know, shouldn't a guy be able to field it? But then I looked, and this was when the exit velocity wouldn't come up right away. You'd have to, you know, wait a few seconds and see it on the computer. And it was 118 miles an hour. And I said, okay, you know, my thinking was that was just too hot to handle cleanly, and when I see a 118 that goes with it, I know it's not just my eyes that are fooling me. That thing was really smoked. And then maybe for the next time, if I see a grounder hit that hard and it's fumbled a little bit, I might feel more secure in saying a hit, that thing was just hit too hard for somebody, you know, even when it's right at him and stays down on him, to be able to come up with.
Stu, there are some players when they're up at bat where the umpire will be more lenient with balls and strikes because the batter has such a reputation for having such a sharp eye. And so maybe they get the benefit of a call. Do you have any situation where you might judge a player differently because of who the player is on a play?
Yeah, well, we try not to for a fielder. Because, and that even means if there's an infielder who's playing in the outfield and messes something up, and people will say he's playing out of position. And I said, well, we're judging him against the average left fielder, not against the third baseman who got stuck out there in left field. But I try to not, and, you know, you'll get it sort of both ways. The second year I was on the job, it was 2008. And there was a ground ball that got by Scott Rolen of Toronto. And I'm well familiar with Scott Rolen. I guess I hadn't realized, though, that he had all these gold gloves in the National League. You know, I mean, he was with the Cardinals, and I definitely knew him, especially as a good hitter. And I got it both ways from, well, in that case, were you holding Rolen to a higher standard because he's a gold glover? And I said, well, no, because I didn't even know he had that many gold gloves in the National League. But on the other hand, you'll get people who will just say, well, the guy's just not good enough to make that play, as though that means you shouldn't call an error on him. No, that's not really the case either. So, you know, no matter who it is as a batter, you know, and you definitely try to keep your mind out of things. If the guy's going for a league lead and something like that, I intentionally try to stay ignorant on that because I don't want it influencing me. But with fielders too, no, it's, you know, and for outfielders, the great ones, they cover a lot of ground, and they might, I think Jackie Bradley got an error few years ago on something that he had really raced from left center to right center to get, but then he dropped the ball. He was no other outfielder, maybe Byron Buxton or something would have gotten there, but most other outfielders wouldn't have been near it. But he did get there and put himself in a position to get an error. And that's for outfielders, that's how I always look at it. That sometimes they take a bad route and they get turned around, they get messed up, you know, and they mess it up and they don't get an error. But if they do a good job getting to the ball and then just drop it, then they do get an error. But I'm looking at that point on, are they in a good position to make the catch? Are they twisting? Are they in control? And sometimes that means that they are in a good position to get there just because they've got so much speed. And I've shown a video of Danny Santana of the Twins dropping a fly ball. And you know, when you show it to people, I say, anybody want to argue that's not an error? Nobody does because it was so clear cut. But I thought Justin Upton of the Tigers had hit it. And when the ball came off the bat, I thought, gee, that might be in the corner. That looks like trouble. Well, no, there's Santana. He's done a really good job getting to the ball, and then he drops it. And I checked in the catch probability, which might be a really effective thing for determining fielding ability. Means nothing to us because the catch probability on that was under 50%. It would have been, if he had made it, I think it would have been judged as a 4-star catch, but he gets an error on it. So that's what one of the things I say is we can ignore catch probability for our purposes. for others making evaluations, it might be great, but we're still looking at what is the position of that fielder at the time that the ball reaches him.
I was just curious, the difference in the move of the stadiums going from a dome stadium to an outdoor stadium, how did that change your how you watched the game, and was there really any difference overall to how you, not how you score the game, but, you know, just viewing the game itself?
Well, going from the artificial turf at the Metrodome to grass at Target Field, I liked it because I'd really rather have to make decisions on ground balls when it's on grass, where if it takes a bad hop, you're at least going to see it. And the turf at the Metrodome, and we would get complaints from the players that we can't see how tricky that grounder is because it's skipping off the turf, it's shooting, it's doing all of this. And at least with regular grass, you can see it. I know one time that what I thought was, and others thought was, a pretty routine error, ground ball. It was to Adrian Beltre of Seattle. Missed right at him, I think a two-hopper. It wasn't hit that hard. And he fumbled it. And the batter was unhappy that he didn't get a hit. And the coaches were unhappy. And the team official came to me and said, they say that ball skips. You can't see it from up there. Well, first of all, I can't. You're right. I can't see it from the press box. But I said, well, would they want me to come down during batting practice and watch it there? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, they want me to bring a glove they can hit grounders to me. And Dustin Morris of the Twins, their communications guy, real, real good person. He said, well, yeah, you know, they did mention that. So before the next game, I showed up. I didn't go down on the field all, but I had it. I had my bag. I had my glove. I had my spikes. I had gym shorts. Of course, I had a nut cup. And they decided not to hit grounders to me. One of the things is that they'd be hitting fungos, and, you know, it's a little bit different. One of the coaches said, man, I'd need an air cannon to hit it as hard as he hit it the other night. But I just, if nothing else, I thought, I'm showing my face. You want to talk to me? You want to complain to me? You want to mentor me? You know, and I'll listen. And one of the coaches finally was talking to me, and it was kind of helpful, but I thought the bigger thing of it was just a little relationship building thing.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain to what data casting is? I guess it's online baseball.
Yeah, so if you go to game day on the MLB.com site, and you might have it as an app on your phone, or you can just call up the MLB site and click on game day. And I've been doing that, well, since before MLB.com had it, since 98. It was Total Sports at the time. And, of course, this was without all the real fancy stuff. But now, well, they've got all the StatCast info in there. And I think the Metrodome was one of the first places, and I don't remember which year, 2004, where they got to install the cameras for the pitch track, for the pitching. So you'll see all sorts of things if you want to enhance it for, you know, the speed of the pitch, the break of the pitch. I think they might have spin rate on it. Well, I'm not doing anything with that. I'm just marking, was it a called strike, a swinging strike, foul ball, a ball blocked in the dirt. If it's put into play, I'm just, well, in fact, that's automatically noting where the ball was hit. And then if it was hit to the second baseman and he throws him out, then I would just be, well, it used to be we'd type in 4-3 dash or slash G for ground ball. Now we're doing a little bit more mouse clicking to click on it. The batter was out. It was a ground ball. And I can either type in the 4-3 for it or just do a couple mouse clicks. So the entry from us in the press box is just pitch by pitch, play by play. And, of course, it's with all of the radar camera-based analytics that they have to go with it, you get a heck of a lot more out of watching it if you're interested in that level of detail.
Stu, we had an announcer in New York, famous announcer, probably a lot more famous as a baseball player, Phil Rizzuto, who growing up, I thought, had coined the phrase, holy cow. Turns out, apparently, that he didn't.
Well, we have a broadcaster here in town who goes back before Phil Rizzuto, Halsey Hall, and our Society for American Baseball Research chapter is named after Halsey. And I did a biography on it, and I just at least pointed out that he was saying it before Rizzuto would have been in the broadcast booth. Of course, you know, everybody can still, you know, argue it. And one of the things is that Halsey was doing it for a minor league team, the Minneapolis Millers. And then it got to be between Rizzuto and Harry Carey, you know, on who was using it first for the major league team. But we're proud of Halsey Hall around here. So when that one comes up, we like to point out Halsey was doing it before any of the others.
You've written a lot of publications and a lot of things. And one of the things is on the Minneapolis Millers, which had a lot of Hall of Famers.
Yeah, they were a great team. And they were, well, I was 5 years old when they played their last game. And I was about 2 months old when they played their last game at Nicollet Park. I sure knew all about Nicollet Park. I would hear about it from my dad, my mom lived about six blocks away from that as she was growing up. My dad was an usher there, but from Halsey Hall, because he was by this time the color analyst on Twins broadcast. And that's what I grew up on. A great broadcast team with Herb Carneal, and then for a number of years, Ray Scott. And I think Ray Scott is as great a sports announcer as there ever was. So I'd hear the stories from Halsey. And I think it was more the interest, because I've got the interest in the ballparks. My interest in Nicollet Park that eventually got me into the overall interest of the Minneapolis Millers. And I was aware of some of the great players, Willie Mays, Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski. So I started researching that, became fascinated by it. There's others, Rube Waddell and Monty Irvin and players like that. So there's something like 15, 16 Hall of Famers who played with the Millers. I think Orlando Cepeda may have been the last one to be elected to the Hall of Fame out of that bunch. And they were a good team, and they had the rivalry with the St. Paul Saints, and the Saints played at Lexington Park, which was about the same age as Nicollet Park, another great old ballpark. The Saints had they were a Brooklyn farm team for a while, so they had Roy Campanella and Duke Snyder. Walter Alston managed them, and of course now it's interesting. It was kind of known, I guess, for the last few weeks, but it became official yesterday that the Twins are going to affiliate with the current St. Paul Saints team, which is separate from the historic one that ended in 1960 when Major League Baseball came to the area. But I was looking at it, trying to find if there were any teams with an affiliate closer than that. I drove the distance between the ballparks on Sunday, came out to 10.4 miles. And of course, the first thing that's coming up to me is when the Giants had AAA team, in addition to Minneapolis and Jersey City. And the Yankees were in Newark. And as I've been trying to do a map quest and, you know, look at what the, you know, if you go through the Lincoln Tunnel and take the most direct route, that still seems to be about 15 to 20 miles between those ballparks. So it's going to be interesting. I've been reading some of the comments from both the teams. Saints are promising not to change their atmosphere. The Twins are saying, no, we're not going to tone them down, if anything. Some of the fun antics that they do at Saints games might make their way to Target Field.
As Gary knows, Brooklyn and City Field is what, Gary, 20 miles?
Something like that, yeah. They're fairly close, but they're not AAA, so.
Well, I was looking at that, too. Yeah, well, I mean, depending on, you know, how long to get there.
Yeah,
but I think I even did a City Field to Coney Island. And I mean, it looks close together on a map, but New York's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks close together between Minneapolis and St. Paul because the downtowns are about 9 miles apart. And then I also did the Yankees and Staten Island, even though they won't have Staten Island anymore. And that would be, well, equally about 20 miles, and that's with the most direct route of taking the ferry as well. If you take the Narrows Bridge, it's going to be longer. So, but you know, I guess it makes sense for all teams, especially with their high affiliates, to be close. Now, you know, I never know. They could be the St. Paul team could be on the road when they want to call somebody up, but on the other hand, it might be 9 miles away. They call somebody, maybe he lives in the Midway area of St. Paul, and instead of driving 5 miles east, they call him and he drives 5 miles west to Target Field. I was looking at the other teams that have that advantage. Boston will still have it, even though Pawtucket is not their farm team, but Worcester's probably about the same distance, and that's farther than 10 miles, about maybe 40, 45. And Seattle was Tacoma. That was one of the easiest jaunts. I think that they, when I was at the new field in Seattle when it just opened, and they had a guy who was getting shuttled between the majors and minors so much, they said, this guy should get a place in Federal Way, which was midway between Tacoma and Seattle. But convenient for the players, too. You don't have to pack up and move when you get sent down to the minors.
Well, we as Met fans here, we know that, you know, how bad it can be when there's a distance. When the Mets were in Las Vegas and needed to call somebody up in the travel, you know, it was not good. Now at least they're in Syracuse, so they're AAA, and that'll be quicker. But I was wondering, how do you feel about all of this shakeup with the minor league baseball and the cut down of the minor league? Minor leagues completely, the reduction of the entire short season schedule and all of that.
Yeah, I guess it's going to get filled in different ways. You know, I was thinking back about a year ago because we knew it was coming, and we knew that the teams were going to go from about 160 down to 120, and really it lops off the short A and I guess the rookie league. And I just figure, well, I'm sure the independent leagues are going to be getting more teams and having a role with that. And I see that they're also doing these what they're calling partner leagues. Of course, Trenton just got dumped out of that. That was a tough one. They got a nice ballpark there, Eastern League, good league. And they're going to be – that's not a partner league. The Pioneer League is going to be a partner league. What did they – Development League. Is that it that Trenton's going to be in?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
So looking a little bit more at – I suppose – you know, obviously they love efficiency and – efficiency is good in some ways, but we all know the costs of efficiency, and we're going to be seeing that. I'm hoping that at least the towns that have had their teams are still going to have some kind of team, whether it's an independent team or something like that. But, you know, in Minnesota, what we have, too, that's very big is town ball. It's adult amateur baseball. It's not American Legion. It's adults and there's like 300 teams, and so many of them around the state have just got their own ballpark. It's not like they go play at the high school field, and it's just a great thing for traveling around to see. But for those communities to have that too, it's big, and it's larger places. Whether it's, you know, Burlington, Iowa, or something, I guess they'll still have a team. But what are some of the leagues that are going to, you know, the Northwest League, that's a short season, Boise and Eugene, I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. I don't know if you guys go back to the loss of National League Baseball in New York, but when a city loses its team, that's a huge loss to the people who are big fans, you know. I mean, maybe some people are more fans of a different sport, but for anyone who's a big fan of the team, we lost the Minnesota North Stars in 1993, and certainly there's a lot of hockey fans here. That was a huge hole, and we got another team. We've, you know, there's been talk of losing the Twins at times. Now they've got Target Field, so that's safe. And yeah, I feel bad for Montreal now. I've been up there and been to games and hoping it somehow works out that Montreal gets a team, but also the minor league cities and places where I've gone and been to games in Kenosha, Wisconsin, at a great old ballpark, and seen how much the people there enjoyed the team. And they don't have a minor league or a professional team. I think they've got one in the Northwoods League, which is a pretty good, not on a par with the Cape Cod League, but developed into a really good wood bat college summer league. And they've got another one out east where I think they train umpires. It's, you know, the umpires coming out of the two academies in Florida, and they're not one that I know is Emma Charlesworth Sealer. She's from here, and I got to know her. She came up to me one time and wanted to shadow me as an official scorer, so she came to some games and then worked her way into umpiring. So she, I think it was in 2017, her first year, Rookie League, Gulf Coast League, and then short season A-League, Northwest League. She was in the Midwest League in 2019. We got to go down and see her umpire. She was going to be in Carolina League in last year, and she's not sure where she'll be. But so now some of those leagues are gone. But I was talking with Dusty Dellinger because I'm doing a profile on Emma. And Dusty was saying, yeah, there's two women who are in, he told me what the name of the league is. It's College Woodbat League. But the umpires are being supplied straight out of the academies because they don't just have a rookie league to go to anymore. So they're going to be, you know, you got to have player development. You have to have umpire development, too. Sure.
Mm-hmm. You talked about your travels, and I see you were the official scorer for the World Baseball Classic Games in Guadalajara, and you also been to Cuba. Could you talk about those experiences?
Yeah, in Cuba, we went on a baseball trip. I wasn't doing any work, stat work, or scoring. That was a terrific trip. Kit Krieger out of Vancouver has been – we went on the first one in 2001, and Kit has led a baseball tour to Cuba every year since. The Guadalajara, the World Baseball Classic was really something. And the one thing, the games were long. They were long. They were wild. Some were pretty exciting. I was getting sensory overload. And certainly the final game, well, there was a tiebreaker game, but it was kind of to determine who was going to make it into that tiebreaker between Mexico and Venezuela. And the crowd and everything there. And Mexico had Adrian Gonzalez. Italy was there, too, with a lot of major leaguers. But, gee, that Venezuela and Puerto Rico team that were down there, you've got Hall of Famers on that from Salvador Perez and Altuve and Miguel Cabrera. Felix Hernandez pitched. One thing about the pitching, you know, they're on limits of about 50 pitches, so you're not really going to see that much. And then Puerto Rico with Correa and Lindor and Javier Baez. And some really, really good games. And my wife speaks Spanish, so they had her working to be the press box translator. You know, and normally at the ballpark, we've got a microphone that we announce a hit or an error. And she was we were in separate locations, but I would get to her what I was calling it, and then for the people in the press box, she could announce it in English and in Spanish. So that was a terrific experience, and I don't know when they're going to play it again. I don't know if I'll get asked to go somewhere. I'd love to.
Stu, you have something that I actually enjoy myself. You have an obsession with graveyards. Is that
and you do too, Len? Huh?
Oh, yeah, I like to go look at the old stones and yeah. I don't know. I can't explain it, but apparently it's something that we had a guest on. Ralph Carhart, he wrote...
Oh, absolutely. Great, right? Yes.
So you also go to, well, you go to graveyards and you look for presidents, right? Former presidents.
Presidents, Hall of Famers, right. Manson victims, quirky stuff. Well, you know, people like you, Len, you can enjoy cemeteries in so many different ways. One is just the peace and serenity of them, but looking for the old stones and doing different things, enjoying the architecture of the grave markers. And I got going about, I went to my first Hall of Fame grave when we went to Hawaii in 95, and just on the itinerary, I put Alexander Cartwright's grave on it. And I got to, later that year, I got to Babe Ruth's grave and enjoyed seeing all the offerings on it. But a couple years later, because, you know, there's a lot of people. We're not really that as weird as we think we are as people. There's a lot of people who do this kind of stuff. And
right.
One of my traveling buddies in our sports group, the guys who would go around, he liked it too. So on our sports trips, we were going to all types of graves, but certainly the presidents and the Hall of Famers. And I think I've completed the Hall of Fame group a couple of times. Of course, they keep dying. So, and right now, man, I'm probably 8 to 10 that I haven't been to. We've had there's quite a year. It was 6 Hall of Famers died this year.
Yeah, so. Yeah, 6.
And I think, you know, I got current again at one point, and that was after they had the induction of 16 Negro Leaguer, pre-Negro Leaguers, and all of them were dead. And I'd been to a couple already. I met Ralph one time. He's been so helpful. Because Cristobal Torriente, It's still kind of up in the air if he's buried in Cuba. And we had been to that cemetery and those monuments that have the graves in it. And Ralph had been on a later trip to Cuba. But he had told me that he found that Torriente was buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in Queens. Just, you know, you always go by it if I'm going from LaGuardia into Manhattan. So we were coming in for the official score meetings, and he said he would meet me there. And so we had the cab from JFK. I was hoping this guy just wouldn't think it was too weird or that he's going to get... I said, we need to go to Manhattan, but can we stop at a cemetery? And he did it. And I know they... And Ralph was there, and he took us to Torriente's grave. And I just remember it was a pretty high cab fare, which I was expecting. I also tipped the driver. He was real good about it, too. But, yeah, Ralph, I've got his book, and, you know, and his mission wasn't just, you know, it's not that tough to get to them when they're dead. You know, you might have to go out of your way a little bit, but they don't move on you. But he had that haul ball that he got – he had a few that just wouldn't do it, but to get to the, all the living ones and get them to agree to hold the ball for a picture, what Ralph did was really incredible.
It was amazing.
Yeah, they don't make good interviews, you know.
Some of them, you never know. Some of them, might be better than the live ones that Ralph had to deal with. Yeah.
This is true.
So you must have been in our neighborhood, because we have a Hall of Famer buried not too far from Lennon, I, and Gary in Uniondale, John Montgomery Ward.
Yeah, that's we did kind of a circuit. Brenda and I went out for the weekend. Yankees and Red Sox were playing, and we I think we went into Albany, and we were doing Presidents, you know, get over to Vermont for Calvin Coolidge, and down through Connecticut. And then I think we got up real, real early. We were staying, staying in Waterbury, Connecticut. And it was a Friday, so, you know, it's still going to be a traffic day. So I wanted to get into, we're onto Long Island early. So I guess we would have taken the Throgs Neck Bridge over. And Teddy Roosevelt is buried up in Oyster.
Yep.
Oyster Bay. I had to climb the fence. It wasn't open yet. And then we swung around. But, yeah, we got John Montgomery Ward in Uniondale, and then into Brooklyn to do Jackie Robinson, some others. We went to a couple of games at Yankee Stadium. And then on the final day, I think we worked our way back up the Hudson to Albany to be stopping at others on the way. So we got a lot in that time. Presidents, Hall of Famers, a couple of Yankees, Red Sox games. I thought that'd be kind of interesting with a rivalry. And there was sort of a level of ugliness in the stadium at that point, you know, with more F-bombs than usual. And you usually do hear a lot in New York.
Right.
Well, Stu, you had two kittens, which you named one Jeter and one A-Rod. So can
yes.
I assume that in a Boston Yankee rivalry, who you root for?
Yeah, that would be it. You got it. So I know you guys are Mets fans, and I got nothing against the Mets. But and A-Rod is not with us anymore, but the cat we got for him is named Mickey. I'm surprised we really didn't go with Mickey before, because, you know, to me, Mickey is it. It's not even Jeter or A-Rod or any of that. It's the Mick. So and Jeter's still with us. He's doing pretty well. He's getting up there in years, and Mickey's still a little younger and feisty. So we do have Mickey and Jeter now.
So, could you talk about the books you've authored? I mean, I've seen a couple of baseball books, but you've done quite a collection of books under your wing there.
Yeah, well, it's the first book I did, which came out in 1988, was on the Minneapolis Millers, the minor league baseball team. And the next one was on the Lakers, and really focusing more on the years in Minneapolis, because they won 6 league titles. The NBA will recognize only 5 of them, and had George Mikan, the greatest player. And that was what was great about that, was that so many of these players were still in town, or at least accessible to talk to by phone, and getting to know them. And these were players, you know, you can't, if you go back to the beginning of Major League Baseball, well, you know, they're all dead. But going back to what is really the beginning of Major League Basketball is post-World War II. And people like Mikan and Vern Mickelson, Jim Pollard I talked to on the phone. He was out in California. Being able to get to know those guys. And then I did the biography in Halsey Hall. And then it just is into different things. Got an opportunity to write children's biographies. And I've done more of that. When I tell people I write, if I refer to the non-children's books that I write and I say adult books, I realize that has a little different connotation. And maybe I should, because, you know, boy, I could, those would probably really take off. But the adult books, I don't know, it's been more on local Minnesota history, which is, I like doing that. It makes kind of more of a splash. You know, it's not going to make the splash across the country, but it's easier to make a splash with it just locally. I did a book, Baseball in Minnesota, in about 2004, and in fact we're just updating that right now. That was sort of all encompassing on it. And my wife and I, we weren't yet married. We discovered if we could do a book together, we could probably handle marriage. And it was on the uses of electricity in medicine. And it kind of came up, the children's publisher was looking to do something like that and wanted to be able to talk to Earl Bakken, the founder of Medtronic. And, well, I think anybody could have just called up and he would have been open to it, but I had a connection to it. So next thing I know, they're saying, you want to do the book? Yeah, okay. And my wife is much more science-minded than I am, so we co-authored that. And I guess the only other non-sports book I've done is, it's called 6 Feet Under, and it's on graves of notable Minnesotans. So I had fun for about a year learning a lot of history. I mean, we know the politicians, Hubert Humphrey or Bronco Nagurski in football, or Wes Westrum is, you know, buried up in northwestern Minnesota. We still don't have any baseball Hall of Famers in Minnesota. We might, but I don't know if I'll still be around when that happens. But learning a lot of history and from all aspects of it, and then getting around the state. But it is more mainly sports books, mainly baseball books that are more specific to Minnesota.
As we wrap up, Gary, do you have anything else?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Len?
I do.
Okay.
I actually do. So this is a little different than what we've been discussing, but you have, if you go to StuThornley.net, and your history, is amazing. I can only say that reading about you, I was like, wow, this, I don't even know where, you know, there's so many different directions to go in. But one of the things that I found was extremely interesting was your dad was in a German prisoner of war camp during World War II.
Yeah, and it was Stalag 17, the one that they made the movie off of. I think I started that website in 2000. It goes off into all directions, but it becomes a good repository for the research about the Millers. And I've got things like every game by game, every game the Millers have ever played. I've got pages for our cats, pages on the graves. So I made two pages on my dad. He was a gunner on a B-17, was shot down in December 43 and in occupied Holland. But so captured and ended up in Stalag 17. And it's Donald Bevan and Edmund Trzynski were the ones who wrote the play that became the movie, Stalag 17. My dad knew them. And some of the things that happened in the movie were kind of based on real things. And my dad had, for a book that never did happen, but the author got him to fill out a questionnaire. And I had heard the stories from my dad and should have been writing them down or recording it. So we were fortunate that somebody did that for us. And so I had that and I made a web page out of it with the questions and answers that my dad provided and also some writing and things that he wrote up on it. And then a separate page, well, the greatest keepsake I have is a small Bible my dad had with him on that mission. And, you know, the plane went down, he parachuted out, and it was in about 1950 that it came back to him in the mail. Somebody in Holland, a man had, you know, planes coming down around him, and this Bible lands at his feet. And, you know, he hit it. The Germans were there. And it took him a number of years. But he sent it to my dad with a letter. And this author who was going to be doing the book, he never did the book, but when he was over in this coastal town in the Netherlands where my dad had been captured, he went to this person's house. This guy was dead, but his widow was there, and I guess she remembered it, and she sent back some things from their town for my mom. So I have the Bible and the letter, and I've got a picture of both in the on the website. So yeah, thank you for plugging that. It's you never know what direction it goes off into.
And that Bible is a special Bible. It's obviously special for the significance, but didn't it have like a special metal outside?
Yeah, that's what it was, because I think they were selling them stateside. It might have been my dad's sister who sent this to him. And it was a small Bible. It wasn't as big as normal, but it had a metal plate in it. And, you know, you'd send it to your loved one overseas and he would wear it over his heart. And my dad said that day he normally did, you know, he had coveralls with pockets on them, and he opened his locker that day and his coveralls were gone, and he grabbed another pair that didn't have pockets. So he said that he just had the Bible at his feet. Well, you know, now when the plane gets shot down, you're not thinking about that. So it flew out with a plane. So yeah, I'm trying to I have to look to see if that plate was still in there when it came back. I thought it was. I have it in my downstairs office. I'll have to look.
That's amazing.
Yes, absolutely. Stu, as we wrap up, do you have anything you want to have any social media if people want to get in contact with you? Obviously, go on to your website, stuthornley.net.
Yeah. Yeah, if anybody wants to, that'd be great. And then there's links to an email. And, you know, if my name were Jeff Cohen, I'm sure there's one or two more of those people in the world. There's only one Stu Thornley. So people usually, it's not too hard. You can Google or anything like that. I'm pretty easy to track down. Love talking to people. And so, you know, great. That's probably the best way to do it. I'm on Twitter, but I don't tweet much, but I'm on it.
Well, we love talking to you, Stu. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry that, you know, that we have to end this, because we only, as they say, we only scratch the surface.
Yeah, well, I enjoy it. This is what I enjoy doing. And, you know, and what's been come about in the last few months is a lot of people are learning how to use Zoom. And I've been enjoying both, you know, being on something like this, but Jeff and I were on the New York Giants Preservation Society. They're doing weekly meetings via Zoom, and it's great to get together in person. But on the other hand, I've been staying kind of busy. There's a lot of good stuff out there, such as the baseball and barbecue too, that helps us when we complain about having to get cabin fever and all that. Well, there's things like this to be spending our time.
Well, thank you. Thanks to Gary Mack for joining us.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks again, Stu. We really enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Stu.
See you later.
Jeff, sometimes you have someone on and you think you're going to talk about one specific thing, and it just goes in so many different directions.
Mm-hmm.
The guy is a writer. Stu Thornley writes. He's the official scorer. He visits the cemeteries.
He visits the cemeteries.
And then his to talk about his father. And I mean, just you didn't I didn't expect everything that interview gave us. And I am really pleasantly surprised. Really great guest. And of course, to have Gary Mack on with us, who just adds his own, you know, his own style to it. Mm-hmm. He also has just been a great help to us. We know that. So thankful that we had them on. And you know what, Jeff? It's unfortunate, but episode 91 is over.
It's a wrap.
Yeah. And how do we wrap it?
How do we wrap it? Go ahead, Len.
We wrap it with the poet, Shel Krakowski, the musician, Dave Dresser, and the song, Baseball Always Brings You Home. Everybody, we'll see you on episode 92. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Thank you.
stay.